This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to reason.com/podcasts. In a time of global pandemic, soaring unemployment, massive wildfires, and racial strife, it feels like the world is going to hell. It's not, says Reason Science correspondent Ron Bailey, the co-author with humanprogress.org's Marian Tupi, of a new book called 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know, and many others you will find interesting. It's a great title for a great book. In 1820, Bailey tells me in our conversation, 84% of the world's population lived on the equivalent of less than $1.90 a day. It took 160 years to get that number down to 41%, but since then it's now below 10%, and will probably be at 5% or less by 2030. Bailey's new book also shows that forests are increasing in size, deaths from natural disasters are declining, and there are fewer autocratic governments than ever. He does believe that climate change will be a significant problem in the future, but it's one that can be handled with technology and economic growth. The main reasons for massive and persistent progress are better ideas for organizing human society. Basically, he says, the Enlightenment happened. With that came the rise of representative government, property rights and markets, and especially a belief in free speech and open inquiry that are essential for technological and social innovation. In a wide-ranging conversation, Bailey also tells me why we don't appreciate progress as much as we should, and why politicians and folks in the media are so slow to acknowledge how much better things really are. Here is the Reason interview with Ronald Bailey. Ronald Bailey, thanks for talking.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Give me the elevator pitch of 10 global trends every smart person should know.
Well, part of the reason I came up with the idea for this book is I wanted to figure out how to get information to people very quickly and very simply. So what we have done, we've designed a book where essentially you have a trend and then 250 words explaining the trend to the people. So then get it, the information really fast. Mm. Now, the thing is that most of the trends in the book are fairly positive in a sense. Why? Largely because most people already know, or most smart people already know, the bad trends, as it were. These are the kinds of things that we have mentally that we already attend to. So my thought is, and I wanted to get across to people, there's a huge amount of progress that's taken place that a lot of people just don't take into account, especially smart people who are attending to the real problems of the world, but not getting the long-term view, which is what we try to provide in this particular book.
Yeah, and if there is a kind of patron saint hovering over this, am I right to say it would be the kind of the ghost of Julian Simon, the wonderful economist who was called the Doom Slayer by Wired magazine back in its early days. And one of the things that he insisted on doing was showing, as you know, whenever you were talking about a trend, he would ask people to get make the trend line as long as possible. Because, you know, if you're talking about 5 years or 10 years or even 100 years, something could look terrible. When you map it over, you know, 3 times, 10 times that, suddenly things look very different.
Exactly. And yes, indeed, we do obviously acknowledge Julian Simon as, if you will, the patron saint of this particular work.
So, you know, there are 10 trends, 10 global trends, and then you have, you know, dozens of smaller trends that are broken down. Again, it's a wonderful format. The book, you know, is just to gush a little bit, it is beautifully designed. It looks great. It's a very info-rich and info-friendly text. So, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Out of the top 10, I want to ask you about a couple in particular, just as, and this gives a flavor of what the book is like. One of the trends, you know, the very first trend is the great enrichment, which is an idea that since around 1800 or the start of the Industrial Revolution, global humanity has just gotten vastly richer in a way that is unimaginable. Right. The second trend that you point out, which I think is less understood, is the end of poverty. What do you mean? What is that trend and why is it so important that smart people, and I assume dumb people, should know about it.
Well, yes, everybody should know, but certainly smart people should know. If you will, that is the flip side of the great enrichment. But the point is, we wanted to point out that the great enrichment didn't just go to the top 1%, as some would say, that it has actually spread across the globe. And one of the things you can look at is, let's face it, the natural state of humanity is abject, violent, ignorant poverty. And one of the benchmarks you can look at is what they call absolute poverty threshold, which is living on $1.90 per day per person. And these are in real dollars. In fact, if you need to look it up, it's 2011 international dollars for the nerds out there. And what we find is around 1820, 84% of the world's population lived on less than that a day. And that it took 160 years for that to get down to only 41%, 160 years. But since then, it's now below 10%. In fact, the last data we have from the World Bank is down to 8.6% and will probably be 5% or less by 2030 if current trends continue.
And these trends are, this is happening faster than even the most optimistic people were predicting 30, 40 years ago.
Yes, it's absolutely speeding up. What happens is that modern technologies diffuse faster and faster to the developing world, and people take advantage of those much more quickly. I should also point out that it was also a result of globalization. I know that this is not a nice thing to say for a lot of people out there, but the fact of the matter is that spreading free trade around did help alleviate poverty around the world.
We're going to talk about the large causes of the trends you're talking about, but it's good to know. And it kind of, obviously, to the extent that the nationalist right is anti-globalization now, it kind of puts a thumb in their eye, but it also of the anti-global left, right, which was pushing back
exactly.
against all sorts of trade deals and, bringing down of barriers, only 20, right. 30 years ago. Some of the other trends, the wealth of resources everywhere, that we're not running out of anything,
right.
Peak population, end of famine. I'm of an age where I grew up always being told about famines in Asia and in
right.
India and whatnot, and in Africa. We really don't hear about them anymore, and that's kind of a beautiful silence. Here's one that I want to dial in on a little bit. More land for nature. This
right.
is something that you just don't hear about very much. What is it and why is it a good thing?
Well, we have several different trends that address that, but the specific one that I'm thinking about is the top trend. Most people don't know that actually the forests around the globe have been expanding since 1980s, and kind of amazingly so. Of course, there's deforestation taking place in places like Brazil and so forth still, and that's largely because they're taking place in the commons that are ungoverned and so forth, and there's just no way to stop it at this point. But if you look broadly across the entire globe, what you find is that the forests have expanded since the 1980s to an area that's about the size of Alaska and Montana combined, basically 800,000 square miles of land. And
why
that's continuing to go.
Yeah, why are we getting more forests and why, independent of being a nature lover, why would that be a good thing?
Well, we're getting more forests because our crop productivity has gotten so much better. We're raising more food on less land all the time. And so that's the chief thing is largely abandoned farmland. That happened in the eastern United States back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and now that trend is expanding around the globe. And the reason that it's a signal. If this expanding forests are a signal in the following way. There are a lot of people who are concerned about species extinction, that in fact, where humanity is pressing in on natural areas and more species are likely to go extinct. If the forests start expanding, and I think we have good data that that's going to happen, and we have another one where we look at peak farmland that shows how that might happen mm-hmm. over the next half century, then that will leave more space for nature to expand and flourish and avoid the problems of extinction that people are worried about.
What is, I guess to extend it a little bit, okay, so more trees are good because they give us, or they create a habitat for more species, but why, why are more species a good thing?
Well, among other things, part of it is the aesthetic enjoyment of it. I mean, you want to think about, I've had the wonderful experience of being able to walk beside rhinoceroses and in South Africa, you know, 10 feet away.
If I may, I think the honor was theirs.
I don't think so. But anyway, or swim with penguins in the Galapagos. And I think the future generations should have that opportunity as well. There's also the concern that if you keep taking pieces out of ecologies, that they might simplify and stop providing services that we do want. And, you know, again, the evidence that this is, we're at any such tipping point at this point doesn't really exist, but it might be a good idea to avoid it in any case.
And yeah, I mean, we're not going through a mass extinction as is sometimes caused, but what you're saying is it's a good thing to plan against.
Right.
With the kind of the return of forests and more land for nature, is part of it. I've heard that you know, some of the reforestation, particularly in the United States, or I guess in North America more generally, are timber farms and things like that. And some critics say, you know, it's better to have more trees rather than few, but you don't want to have, you know, just the same thing everywhere. What you want is a kind of rich, varied ecosystem, because that is beneficial to, you know, supporting species as well as keeping plant diversity alive and things like that.
Well, first of all, that's not what the reforestation trends are that I'm citing are pointing to at all. But interestingly, another work that I've done before, and I'll just bring this up, is that we could probably raise all the timber that humanity needs on about 5% of the forest land if we devoted just that 5% to, if you will, timberlands, managed timberlands. And so you would save 95% of the forest from being wild forest from being chopped down by concentrating, as you would a crops, on a smaller amount of land.
Right. Other of the trends, urbanization. We're moving to urban areas, which are, you know, have a lot of positive things, including a smaller footprint on the environment, but also a density of possibilities. You talk about democracy on the margin. You know, one of the things that's interesting about that very quickly, it's not simply that we have more democracies than we had 100 years ago, certainly, but we have fewer autocracies.
Correct.
So that, you know, it's working in both good ways. The long piece you guys talk about, interstate wars declining over the past half century or so. But then you come to what is the 10th major trend that you cite, and that is that we're in a much safer world. What does that mean? And you know, and I guess it answers itself, why is a safer world better than a more dangerous one? But what do you, you know, kind of sketch how much safer we have become over time?
Well, we're looking at data that's been collected over the last century or so with regard to the numbers of deaths. And in this particular chart, we're looking at a rate of deaths from natural disasters. That includes earthquakes, tornadoes, flooding, hurricanes, what have you, all natural disasters as you could think of them. And what we find is that over the period of time is that the rate of death from natural disasters, and remember, world population has increased four times since the beginning of the century, has declined 99% and more.
Okay, can you create an image that gets that across? Because that is a massive improvement, but it's almost so fantastic, it's hard to conceptualize.
Well, for example, if you think about one of the reasons this happens, of course, is that we're much more technologically advanced, and also we have greater wealth, so we can have greater resilience. And this is spreading across the globe. Unfortunately, where natural disasters still are harming people, of course, are where people are the poorest. Unfortunately, poverty and natural disasters are a recipe for tragedy still.
Yeah.
But basically, one of the things you find is that when you have major hurricanes hitting the United States, they used to kill hundreds and sometimes thousands of people. I mean, we take Katrina into account, that's in it here. But typically now, it's almost no one or at most a dozen people. And it's largely because we have warning, we have much more resilient infrastructure, those kinds of things. And that's, again, a trend that's going across the globe.
So it's, you know, we'll talk about global warming or climate change in a second, but it's, we may not be able to control the weather that much, but it's a lot easier to withstand a hurricane or a tropical storm in Miami Beach than it is in Bangladesh.
That's correct. But even it's gotten even better in Bangladesh, right, because they have warning systems and now they can withdraw from the coast, and they've devised ways of doing that. So even the dangers of hurricanes in Bangladesh are much less than they were even 30 years ago.
Right. And this goes to, the first two trends you guys talk about, the great enrichment and the end of poverty. As places get richer, fewer people die, which seems like it's kind of obvious. But again, one of the delights of the book is, that you're making things, I think that in most readers, especially if you consume a lot of news, you'll be reading and it will click, but you'll finally be making connections and understanding things in a way that is, more coherent than it is otherwise.
So
after you have the top 10, then you have, dozens of other trends, and you break it down into different aspects of kind of human activity and whatnot. What was one of the, one of the other trends, like when you were researching this, what was one of the trends that was most surprising to you, either positive or negative?
Well, the one I think that surprised me a little bit was, of course, I've been steeped in this stuff for quite some time, but the one that surprised me the most was that globally speaking, the murder rate has been declining.
Globally. So it's not just in the United States or in Northern Europe or something, or Western Europe. Yeah.
Right. There are still places where you have medieval levels of violence out there. A lot of them, unfortunately, are in Central America. But if you look at the overall trend, interpersonal violence has gone significantly down over the last 40 years or so.
What explains that?
Part of it is the trends with more democracies and fewer autocracies, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So the expansion of the rule of law over time, accounts for part of it, and possibly for a lot of the societies, it's also because the average age of people in those societies is going up, and older people are more peaceful.
What are any of the big trends that you follow? And I guess, let me put it this way. If the age of the planet is going up, and one of the major trends you talk about is peak population, that we are right. either at or near the top level, top amount of people that are on the planet, and it's going to start to decline. Is that a good thing to have an older population? And I'm thinking, virtually everything that I read about this kind of stuff, it comes from either you or Marian over at Human Progress. So I'm feeding you back stuff. But like a country like Japan, which is quite old in terms of its average population, and if I'm not misremembering, it has fewer people now than it had in the year 2000. Its economy, can you grow an economy as the population is getting older and shrinking? Is that a cause for concern, peak population?
Well, I understand those particular concerns, but let's flip it around this way. First, let me get the trend out for you. Basically, it looks like on the best data we could find, the world population is going to peak somewhere around 8.9 billion or maybe 9 billion people, and then decline to about where it is now by the end of the century. And obviously, it does imply the average age on the planet will go up over time. But the way I would flip it back is that I think that trend reflects the fact that people are gaining control of their fertility, that they're making trade-offs over whether or not they want to have more children or fewer children, or invest more in the children that they do have over time. As far as I can tell, and again, I know that there are people who are demographically worried about older societies, whether or not they will be economically dynamic or not. But I think that trend will be, my best guess is anyway, that trend will be subsumed with a trend toward improving technology and greater productivity over time.
All right. So score one for those of us who are over the age of 30. Right?
Absolutely.
Do you worry, I guess this is more of a psychographic question than a demographic one, but are older people less risk averse? Are they less innovative? We often hear that, great composers or scientists and sometimes novelists, they're creative people. If they haven't written a masterpiece by the time they're 30, they're never going to do it. Is an aging population worrisome from the point of view of innovation?
Again, we haven't addressed that particularly in this book, but in other work that I've done, I don't find that that's the case. Is that when you look at countries that have an older population, actually, they tend to grow faster over time than younger ones, economically speaking. That may top out at some point, but the United States is doing fairly well as the population ages over time. But again, there may be a transition. What happens is when societies with younger people come on, there will be a demographic dividend, as it were, because as they go out of school and into the workplace, their growth may speed up. And that might be in places like India and certainly certain places in Africa. Mm-hmm. But again, those depend upon the institutions that those countries have, whether or not they have the rule of law and whether or not property rights are secure, those kinds of things. If you don't have those, you're not going to grow anyway.
Right. You know, one of the big issues, I don't know that it's a trend per se, but one of the big kind of gorillas in the room that you don't really talk about much in the book has to do with climate change, and particularly concerns about catastrophic climate change. Because in a way, you know, these global trends are all great, right? But if the world, you know, ends tomorrow, it doesn't really matter if, you know, we have more farmland, for people who no longer exist or something. Can you talk a bit about, you know, how do discussions of catastrophic climate change and things like that fit into what you're talking about here?
We do address it at the beginning of the book. Basically, what we're trying to do is to talk about trends that people don't know about. Mm-hmm. I suspect that there's no one in the United States who hasn't heard that there is a problem with the climate. So we decided not necessarily that we wouldn't put that one in, though we did put in trends with regard to the emissions of greenhouse gases and that kind of thing. But the question then is, looking down the road, how bad could things get? Again, in other work that I've done, my best guess is that climate change is going to become a significant problem. But my best guess is that we'll have the wealth and the technology for future generations will to be able to adapt to it and to start ameliorating what problems that do arise. There will be sea level rise, and people will have to retreat from the coast. But they're not going to have to retreat tomorrow. They can retreat in 2050.
So the kind of widespread doomsaying that goes on, and as a matter of fact, Joe Biden within the past six months talked about that within 12 years, if we don't get carbon emissions under control, we're fried. Things like that. You do not find that a convincing argument.
No, what he's referring to in his ham-fisted way is that the notion is that if we don't, there's this calculation that if we don't cut back on our carbon emissions by 2030, then we won't meet the threshold of keeping the climate below 1.5 degrees centigrade by 2100. There's no cliff that we're running off of. All it means is, well, it's going to be warmer than 1.5 degrees, most likely. So there isn't the end of the world in 2030 if we miss that deadline.
And to kind of keep it within the book, I mean, some of the trends you talk about, particularly the growth in global GDP, as well as the rate of technological innovation. Again, it's not a question of whether climate change is happening. It is, will we be able to adapt to it, and will we be able to kind of minimize the negative consequences of it?
Yes. And again, if you look at the studies that have come out, first of all, keep in mind, we're combining econometric models with climate models. So grains of salt, salt shakers of salt, whatever. But the best ones that we have basically suggest that climate change is likely to reduce the GDP in the year 2100 by as much as 5% below what it would otherwise have been. On the other hand, the economy is going to grow tenfold over that period of time. So basically, instead of making $100,000 a year per capita in the future generations, it'll be $95,000 per year in real dollars per capita. That's, you know, it'd be nice to have had that extra $5,000, but $95,000 per capita gives, and with modern technologies, I mean, unimaginable technologies that are going to be developed over the next 80 years, gives the future generations a pretty good shot to handle whatever climate is going to throw at them.
I think that's a trend that, or a kind of formulation that a lot of people don't quite understand. So maybe in the expanded edition, that could be the 11th global trend every smart person should know. I guess let's talk about why progress is happening. Is there, you know, is there a single cause, or are there multiple causes, overlapping causes? Why, you know, and again, I mean, let's start with, you know, something like the Great Enrichment up until around 1800, and a lot of, you know, most, there's a consensus that, you know, for 1,000 years or so, human life was kind of flatlining. It wasn't getting better. It wasn't getting worse. You know, it was kind of the same, and it was nasty, solitary, brutish, and, you know, at least it was short. You know, various things happened in 1800 that gave rise to the Great Enrichment. You know, why is progress happening now? What are the main causes?
Well, the chief cause is let's sum it up with the word the Enlightenment happened, basically, the Enlightenment. Essentially, what happened is that, and I always like Jonathan Rauch's formulation, is that three different institutions came into existence about the same time at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. And those were basically democracy as a way to decide who gets to wield power and to be able to throw them out.
By democracy, I mean, broadly speaking, what you're talking about is representative government.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but basically, the leaders were no longer hereditary. You were able to get rid of the bastards if they were not doing the right thing.
I don't know. You know, you're saying that, and I guess it's a, you know, as we speak, the Kennedy dynasty is disappearing, and, you know, the Clinton, the Bush dynasties. So we finally got around to getting rid of our dynasties
Let's get rid of more. But then the second thing is that we ended up, as Rauch would put it, basically, with free markets, is that all of a sudden we had property rights and there was respect for the rule of law. And those kinds of, basically it turned out that everybody had the right to go to court to defend their property all of a sudden. And that was a huge advance over, again, the arbitrary rule of autocrats. And the third stool of this was what he calls, and I think this is the most important one, is called liberal science. And by that, he means it was how we decide what the truth is. And it's essentially a radical notion of free speech, is everybody gets to criticize everybody else, and there are no consequences other than you being shunned for that criticism. And so it goes from the worst blog post on the planet to peer-reviewed science today, or the most rigorous thing. Everything gets checked by everybody else. And that really speeds up innovation.
I guess, you know, that leads into a discussion of, you know, what might reverse these trends. You know, and let me paint a picture here for you. You know, we're talking, it's September 2020. You know, we have not been to our common office at the same time for many months now. There's a global pandemic. There is an economic collapse and retrenchment. There is, in the United States, certainly there is racial strife that has not really been seen since, you know, in 50 or 60 years. You know, is progress capable of being reversed? And if so, what might reverse it?
Progress is capable of being reversed. I think it would be a bad bet, but yeah, let's entertain that as a possibility.
Well, should we be on guard if you talk about, you know, liberal science as kind of, you know, and the internet is in the trend book that you talk about, the way that it has facilitated free expression and dispersed and decentralized knowledge and power. You know, the internet is under attack. Free speech is under attack. You know, I mean, are those things we should be concerned about? Or are you kind of saying, no, you know what, this is a big snowball and we're barely, you know, we're still at the top of the mountain. It's got a long way to go before anything can stop it.
I'm betting on the big snowball, but my main, if I'm thinking about the thing that could make, that could reverse progress, I'm worried about what I think of as turnkey authoritarianism, basically the kind of social credit system that the Chinese are developing, where essentially everybody is tracked at all times, social recognition is pervasive, you are given demerits and merits given how closely you to the party line, and essentially is a pervasive surveillance state where freedom is simply crushed because you are watched at all times. And they are trying to export that technology across the world, and other autocrats are apparently finding it quite intriguing. And so I am afraid of that. And in the particular context of the United States is I'm afraid we're already setting this up, but in a private way, that essentially there's pervasive surveillance that's being established through private hands. But then I can imagine another 9/11 or something worse possibly happening, and a panic then the populace allows the Congress or the executive to decide to use to co-opt the private surveillance networks and impose it on us all through the state. That would scare me.
Can you talk about that in relation to the novel coronavirus and COVID lockdowns and contact tracing and things like that? We seem, if there is a way that we're all going to be tracked and traced, you know, it seems like it's happening, or you know, the pandemic is as good a pretext as a 9/11.
It is the case that people are, I think, overreaching with government power through the excuse of public health. I do want to say that the problem with pandemic is that it's occurring in what I call or think of as an open access health commons, that essentially there's no way that you can privatize it, essentially. What you do in a commons is you can either privatize it or you can regulate it or you can ignore it. And unfortunately, we're choosing an over-regulatory model, I think, with regard to public health in the United States. Can this be? That's a good question. I do think there's been some overreach, but we have to go back and try to remember what happened at the beginning of this when the lockdown occurred. People were looking at what was happening in Wuhan. They were looking at in Italy. No one had any idea of how infectious it was. The fact that it actually highly differentially affected older people was not clear at that point. So there was a precautionary reaction, which was probably too great. But it's hard, we're going to have to put it this way. When we come out of this, this is going to be one of the longest debates in the country ever, is who was right, who was wrong, and it's just going to go on for the next decade.
Well, it's a good thing we have the internet, because otherwise we'd have to invent it in order to have this long, never-ending debate. In terms of turnkey authoritarianism and its ability to kind of stifle the kind of freedom of thought and social experimentation, as well as kind of scientific experimentation, is it that a country like China, say, which is, you know, the paragon of this model, they have to be offering the people that they're subjecting something better? I mean, it's not simply brute force that they use. You know, Milton Friedman was famous, and he talked about this in relation to Hong Kong and to China, you know, back in the 80s, that as people get, you know, autocracies, even in order to survive, they have to deregulate their economy. So there's some growth. So there's some stuff they can spread around to people. As the economy gets freer, people get a little bit richer, and then they start demanding political rights. Do you think that that kind of model just is either has been shown to be wrong, or that it's not as robust as I think a lot of libertarians and a lot of classical liberals once thought it to be?
I still think that's the long run good bet. Though, as I say, I'm very worried that, in fact, the turnkey totalitarianism, the surveillance state, might actually be an end run around that. We're at that point in history where we're going to find this out, and I'm still betting that liberty will win, but I am concerned.
Right. Yeah. And I like the way that you're laying bets here. You're not talking in absolute certitude or even proportional ones. Can I ask, and we've had this conversation, I mean, we've worked together for, you know, 20 plus years, I think, but is there, you mentioned that a lot of this is coming in the United States, and I think in, you know, the developed economies of the world, this is not coming from the government, but it's coming from private industry that will say, you know what, we'll track your packages for you. You'll never have to worry about that. And by the way, we can track your kids, or we can track you. We can send you notes, you know, from the ether about, hey, why don't you go get your cholesterol checked? I could even see, you know, credit card receipts coming, like, you know, you've been eating out a lot, and you've been eating out a lot of fatty restaurants. Maybe it's time for you to do something. But it's the private sector. Libertarian thought in general has often minimized any threat of power from the private sector. It's been much more focused on state power. Do you think we need to change our framework in order to better understand what's going on in the world now?
I think that we should think about how private power could be co-opted at some point. I still worry about state power. I'm much more worried about the co-optation of all that data at some point by the government. I mean, we saw through Snowden how pervasive surveillance was anyway, and that was minimal compared to what could be possible in the future with all these tracking devices. I mean, after all, our cell phones are perfect devices for following us around wherever we are.
Yeah, no, they're it's like the Stasi wet dream, right? And we pay exactly. for it every month. Yeah, you know? So it's like, well, as a, in a closing section, I guess what I would like to ask, is something more optimistic.
That?
Well, no, this is actually, I think I'm going to get even more pessimistic. So, you know, the book is, you know, is a really great testament to, at the very least, and it's partly designed as a kind of coffee table book. This is something that people can look at and discuss. And it's it should be on the coffee table of every, you know, every house in America, every apartment, certainly every school. I realize nobody's in school anymore, but it should be there if and when they get back. But this is a very optimistic book. I love what Marian Tupi is doing at Human Progress. I love what you've been doing at Reason and your career before Reason for decades now. Why don't we know about these trends in the way that every time, you know, a mailbox gets replaced, every time a cop is beating somebody's face in, every time it seems like our kids do less well in school, like we know all of the bad trends. Why don't we understand or why don't we have an appreciation for global trends that every smart person should know, but never really, they don't seem to get talked about very much.
Well, we do talk about that at the beginning of the book, and it's largely because of psychological glitches that humans have. I mean, years ago, of course, when I was first working in journalism, I would try to do good news stories, and my editors would say, who the hell's going to read that? I mean, come on, if it bleeds, it leads. That's it. So what we have is a news media that obviously focuses on what sells, and that is bad news. Mm-hmm. Good news is not news. Bad news is news. Essentially, to build a house takes months, years to do. To burn it down takes an hour. So you point to the burning down because that's what you can focus on. Another glitch, of course, is that progress hides itself. As things get better and better all the time, we move on and go, all right, we've got that win. We don't think about it anymore. We immediately go on to the next set of problems. And so we forget about how much has happened in the past. So progress is always hiding itself. We just take it for granted. And what we're trying to do with this book is to not let people take it for granted and remind people this is what has happened and look to the future. If we keep the same institutions that enabled this, then much more of it will happen in the future.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. I think that's a wonderful way to sum up the hopefully the impact of the book, which is 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know. And many others you will find interesting by Ronald Bailey, science correspondent of Reason Magazine, Reason.com, and Marian Tupi, who runs Human Progress, a project of the Cato Institute. Ron, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Stitcher, at SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there and check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates. Thanks for listening.